The word miracle is tossed around rather loosely these days. If you're an NFL fan, you might be familiar with the 1978 miracle at the Meadowlands, the 2000 Music City miracle, or my personal favorite, the 2018 Minneapolis miracle. If you're at least my age, you can probably hear the voice of Al Michaels in your mind excitedly asking, "Do you believe in miracles?" as the U.S. hockey team beat the Soviet Union in the 1980 Winter Olympics. That semifinal victory, as you know, was instantly dubbed the Miracle on Ice. More generally speaking, the marketplace is full of claims for miracle drugs, miracle diets, and miracle devices. Examples could be multiplied ad infinitum. Of course, as believers, we know that all such uses water down the meaning of the word miracle. But are we also guilty of using the word miracle in ways that are overstretched and far-fetched? Our daughter Emily was born with one-third of her ventricle wall missing and a dime-sized hole in her atrium. Surgeons spent hours reconstructing her heart in an exceedingly risky surgery. In fact, doctors said that she had a 50-50 chance of survival. So when the surgery was a success, family and friends quickly referred to Emily as our miracle baby. Indeed, God's kindness to us that day was extraordinary. But was the positive outcome to the surgery technically a miracle? It all depends on how we define our terms. Traditionally speaking, miracles have been understood as any sort of supernatural intervention that goes beyond what nature typically allows. Let me draw your attention to the fourth definition supplied in your notes. Timothy McGrew describes a miracle as an event that exceeds the productive power of nature. Notice that McGrew says exceeds the productive power of nature, not contradicts the productive power of nature. Over the years, I've heard many Christians define miracles as things contrary to natural law. But this leaves our supernaturalistic worldview vulnerable to philosophical attack. How? You've probably heard of the skeptic David Hume, the 18th century philosopher who famously defined a miracle as a violation of the laws of nature. Hume merely ran with the thought of Jewish philosopher Baruch Spinoza, who said that a miracle would mean God acted in contravention to the laws of nature. And as Spinoza pointed out, the laws of nature are nothing less than decrees of God. This means that a law-breaking miracle done by God would contradict God's own decrees. And this, of course, would make miracles, by definition, absurd. When I realized this, I stopped referring to miracles as things transgressing the laws of nature and started referring to them as things transcending the laws of nature. C.S. Lewis and B.B. Warfield are especially helpful here. In his book titled Miracles, Lewis says this of nature's laws. We are in the habit of talking as if they caused events to happen, but they have never caused any event at all. They produce no events. They state the pattern to which every event, if only it can be induced to happen, must conform, just as the rules of arithmetic state the pattern to which all transactions with money must conform, if only you can get a hold of any money. It is therefore inaccurate to define a miracle as something that breaks the laws of nature. It doesn't. The divine art of miracle is not an art of suspending the pattern to which events conform, but of feeding new events into that pattern. It does not violate the provisio that A then B. It says, but this time instead of A, A2. And nature, speaking through all her laws, replies, then B2, and naturalizes the immigrant, as she well knows how. Warfield captures the implications of this when he writes, the mark of a miracle in a word is not that it is contranatural, but that it is extranatural, and more specifically, that it is supernatural. It is not conceived as a product of nature, different from or contrary to the ordinary products of nature, but as the product of a force outside of nature, and specifically above nature, intruding into the complex of natural forces and producing, therefore, in that complex, effects which could not be produced by the natural forces themselves. The upshot is that defining miracles requires a bit of nuance, and so does categorizing them. On the second page of your handout, I list four degrees or classifications of miracles. First, some miracles are events initiated by a supernatural agent at a specific moment in time, causing an instant result that might have eventually occurred naturally. For example, Jesus healed the fever of Peter's mother-in-law. The fever might have lifted naturally in due time, but Jesus caused it to happen on the spot. Second, some miracles are technically speaking naturally possible, but almost sure to never happen without supernatural intervention. Jesus healing the man born blind comes to mind here. The optic nerve could have developed, but the blind man wasn't holding his breath. Third, some miracles initiated by a supernatural agent are simply not possible naturally. Examples would be the sun standing still in Joshua's day, or the resurrection of Lazarus after his body had already begun decomposing. These things didn't have even the remotest chance of happening without supernatural intervention. Finally, some miracles involve the convergence of several things, none of which are themselves necessarily miraculous, through the grand orchestration of a supernatural agent. Some call these special providences rather than miracles. For example, a supernatural agent might providentially bring the right person at the right time into the right circumstances to bring about an event that wouldn't otherwise happen. So going back to my daughter's open heart surgery, was the successful outcome technically a miracle? Not if we restrict the term to mean something that necessitates supernatural intervention. But perhaps a supernatural agent brought about several details, like doctors who slept perfectly the night before, scalpels sharpened to just the right degree, and steady hands fueled by just the right amount of caffeine. Countless things needing to be just right might have converged at just the right moment under the providential direction of a supernatural agent. And perhaps without that perfect convergence, the outcome would have been tragic. If so, then we might properly classify Emily as a miracle baby. But in the end, we can't be sure this side of eternity. I don't want to nitpick here, but I do want you to think carefully about what you're willing to unabashedly call a miracle and to use nuance where necessary. After all, if you're not careful, you'll leave the Christian worldview open to the charge of absurdity from the likes of Spinoza and Hume. I'm sure you've noted that thus far I've referred to miracles as events initiated by a supernatural agent. This is because there's some debate as to whether miracles are strictly the domain of God, and I wanted to wait until now to address it. On the one hand, the Psalms state several times that God alone does wonders. Take, for example, Psalm 72:18. Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who alone does wondrous things. On the other hand, both the Old Testament and the New Testament refer to signs and wonders performed by demons and those empowered by them. Though Paul calls such works false, lying, or deceiving things, most scholars agree that they are genuine miracles performed with the malevolent intent to mislead. There's real satanic power behind such wonders. So what do we make of this apparent discrepancy? Here's how I've worked it out in my own mind. Nothing in the Old Testament or New Testament suggests that the devil or his demons can perform the kind of miracle that is naturally impossible. They may be able to manipulate the material world to produce amazing feats, but that's as far as it goes. They cannot do miracles like raising a corpse already rotting. They can't replicate the great, naturally impossible miracles done by God. In the strictest sense, then, miracles are solely acts of God. Only God can do what is naturally impossible, and Satan can only do what is naturally possible. We see the difference in quality of miracles in Moses' showdown with the Egyptian magicians in Exodus. You'll recall that when Moses turned Aaron's staff into a snake, the Pharaoh's magicians replicated the feat. The text says they did this through the power of their secret arts. This flex fizzled, though, when Aaron's staff turned snake swallowed the sorcerer's serpent and demonstrated the superiority of miracles done by God. This miracle kicked off a series of supernatural plagues unleashed against the Egyptians. Not surprisingly, liberal scholars have tried to explain away these miracles, claiming them to be nothing more than extreme natural occurrences. Surprisingly, though, several conservative scholars have followed suit. Ever since articles published by Greta Hort in the late 1950s, scholars have argued that at least the first nine plagues had natural causes, even evangelical scholars. Once again, we're faced with the need for nuance. Yes, the plagues involve natural phenomena like frogs and gnats. And yes, their replication could have occurred naturally. But these plagues were unprecedented, progressively cataclysmic, and remarkably selective. Israelites occupying the same space were spared from the frogs, gnats, and other plagues. The killing of just the Egyptian sons, and just the firstborn ones at that, was astonishingly precise. Other miracles took place at very particular times, like when Moses raised his staff or his hands. These sorts of things don't just happen naturally. In the very least, they fall under our fourth type of supernatural intervention, providential miracles. If we had time, we'd explore how miracles in the Old Testament were clustered around three critical periods: the Exodus and conquest, the ministries of Elijah and Elisha, and the exile. For now, just be aware of this fact as we turn our attention to miracles clustered around the ministries of Christ and his apostles. In the remainder of our time this morning, I want to give a brief overview of miracles in the New Testament and then turn attention to our expectations for miracles today. It goes without saying that Jesus is the supremely miraculous person in the Bible. He entered the world via virginal conception and birth as the divine Son made human. The incarnation is perhaps the most staggering miracle in all of human history. The transcendent God drew near by becoming one of us. I'll never recover from this realization. As the God-man, Jesus performed many miracles ranging from healings and exorcisms to natural miracles like turning water into wine, walking on water, and stilling a storm. He even did miracles not naturally possible, like reversing rigor mortis and rot in the human remains of Lazarus. Why did Jesus perform these miracles? It wasn't merely to wow bystanders, though it certainly did that. As we've seen in recent sermons, Jesus' miracles were theological audio visuals that reinforced his divine identity in unforgettable ways. He also did miracles to serve as signs that the first phase of redemption was underway, pointers to the redemption yet to come. We see this in Matthew 8:17, where we read, "He took our illnesses and bore our diseases." As you know, Matthew is citing Isaiah 53:4 here, demonstrating that Jesus' miracles of healing were actually fulfillments of Old Testament prophecy. What you might not know is that Isaiah 53 isn't talking about physical sickness. Rather, the context makes exceedingly clear that spiritual disease is in view. Read Isaiah 53 sometime and tally the references to iniquity, transgression, sin, and guilt. I believe you'll find 8 references to the general concept of sin. Peter picks up this connection when he says, Jesus carried up our sins, and by his wounds we have been healed. The upshot is that Jesus' physical healings were visible representations of the invisible spiritual healing he came to provide. Of course, this is clear in Matthew 9 and Mark 2, where Jesus forgives a paralytic's sins and then restores his ability to walk. In short, the man's walk talked. It was an audio-visual demonstration of Jesus' authority to forgive sins. Jesus' miracles also authenticated him as the Messiah. Though he refused to perform miracles on demand to satisfy his critics, he gave the multitudes signs that revealed his glory. John says these signs were done so we might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. All of this is why Peter said in his sermon on the day of Pentecost in Acts 2 that Jesus was, quote, a man attested to you by God with mighty works and wonders and signs that God did through him in your midst. I'd finally add that Jesus did miracles because he loved people and felt compassion for them. Have you ever noticed that in his public ministry, Jesus healed every single person who ever came to him for help? I find that both remarkable and refreshing. But he didn't heal everyone before he began that public ministry. Indeed, it doesn't appear that he had healed anyone up to that point. Is this why Matthew 13 and Mark 6 say that the people from Jesus' hometown took offense at him? Maybe they wondered why Jesus hadn't healed any of them. I think it's important to point out these details because they show that Jesus prioritized healing people at the onset of phase one in God's plan of redemption. The healings were a sign that a new age had arrived with the first coming of Jesus. That's why Jesus didn't heal everyone before the launch of phase one. And it's why he doesn't heal everyone 2 millennia after that launch was complete. This ought to comfort those today who haven't been miraculously made well, knowing that their lack of healing isn't necessarily a reflection on their spiritual status. Jesus not only performed miracles himself, remarkably, he enabled others to perform miracles of healing and exorcisms in his name. He did this through 2 specifically commissioned groups, the 12 and the 72. You're familiar with the 12. The 72 appear to have been given the same authority as the 12. It even appears that the pool of qualified candidates for apostles in Acts 1 came specifically from the group of 72. Why mention this? Because Jesus didn't teach that all believers could heal diseases, cast out demons, or raise the dead. Rather, he commissioned 2 select groups of disciples and gave them authority to perform these miracles in his name. Not all believers in the first century, let alone throughout church history, can do these things. Acts reports numerous miracles, most explicitly said to have been performed through apostles and prophets, especially Peter and Paul. And you'll notice that these accounts consistently present healing taking place through apostles at will. There is never any doubt that healing will occur. There was something special about an apostle. We see this in 2 Corinthians 12:12 when Paul states that the signs of an apostle were performed among you with great perseverance by signs and wonders and powerful deeds. While this statement doesn't imply that miracles occur only through apostles or that false apostles did not claim to produce similar miracles, it does indicate quite clearly that miracles characterized the ministry of the apostles in a way that was distinct from rank-and-file Christians. In fact, I can only think of 3 possible exceptions to this apostolic distinction. The first possible exception is Stephen. He was the first named of seven deacons appointed in Acts 6 to manage the distribution of food in the early Jerusalem church. So is Stephen an exception to the apostolic rule? It seems to me that he was far more than a deacon. Although Acts doesn't explicitly call him a prophet, it is likely that he should be considered one. Note the following facts we're told about him. He performed great wonders and signs. He spoke powerfully with wisdom and the Spirit. He was transfigured before the Sanhedrin. He gave the longest speech recorded in Acts. He had a heavenly vision, and he was described by Paul as Christ's witness. Stephen is hardly the common Christian. Philip is another possible exception to the apostolic rule. Many speak of him merely as an evangelist, but he performed signs and wonders, including healings and exorcisms, received a message from an angel, and most surprisingly, was transported miraculously after speaking with the Ethiopian eunuch in Acts 8. What's more, we read later in Acts 21 that Philip's four daughters all prophesied. This might suggest that Philip was also a prophet. All told, the evidence suggests that Philip was more than an evangelist. He was certainly no ordinary Christian. The only other possible exception to the apostolic rule is Ananias. Acts 9 reports the Lord speaking to Ananias without causing him any surprise. He received a direct verbal revelation from the Lord to go to the house of a man he didn't know, even receiving directions to the house in order to lay hands on Saul. Significantly, the act of laying hands on someone everywhere in Acts is performed by apostles or prophets. These two pieces of information suggest Ananias also may have been a prophet. He clearly was no everyday Christian. Even if one or more of these three men were not prophets, they are certainly not examples of miracle working as a normal facet of Christian life. All three men were closely associated with apostles. Stephen and Philip, like the apostles, apparently were authorized and empowered to be agents of Christ's healing at will. They are not reported as praying for people to be healed and then waiting to see what happens. They got immediate results. They were not like us. So what about miracles among rank and file Christians? Christians like you and me. Paul taught the Corinthians that the spiritual gifts, the charisma, were distributed among all believers, but no one believer possessed all of them. These spiritual gifts, found in 1 Corinthians 12, evidently included but were not limited to gifts exhibiting the supernatural. Paul begins the list of spiritual gifts at the end of chapter 12 with titles of specific groups of Christians: apostles, prophets, and teachers. He then shifts to types of gifts. He speaks of working of miracles, then miracles, then gifts of healing and helping. Finally, he asks, are all workers of miracles? Two important points emerge here. First, miracles could still occur among believers in churches with or without apostles or prophets as the human agents. A strict cessationism that denies miracles could occur after the apostolic era has no support anywhere in the New Testament. It may be that miracles occurred more frequently in the churches during the apostolic era than they did later, or than they do now, but we have no reason to think they cannot occur. Second, there are no miracle workers as an identifiable group. The translation, "are all workers of miracles," might suggest to the English reader that Paul is referring here to a specific group of people alongside the apostles, prophets, and teachers. But this is not the case. As noted a moment ago, Paul has already shifted his focus from offices to functions. So, for example, he speaks of gifts of healing, a function, not of healers as some sort of group. Similarly, he speaks of workers of miracles, a function, not miracle workers as a group. This distinction is important. It means the claim made by some modern figures that God has called them to be miraculous healers or other types of miracle workers finds no basis anywhere in the New Testament. God might do works of healing and other miracles, but there are no healers or miracle workers. Trust that makes sense. This brings us to the place where the rubber meets the road. What about healing today for you and me? In answering this question, we're hard-pressed to find a more important passage than James 5, 13 to 18. Let me read the text for you. James writes, "Is anyone among you suffering? Let him pray. Is anyone cheerful? Let him sing praise. Is anyone among you sick? Let him call for the elders of the church and let them pray over him, anointing him with oil in the name of the Lord. And the prayer of faith will save the one who is sick, and the Lord will raise him up. And if he has committed sins, he will be forgiven. Therefore, confess your sins to one another and pray for one another that you may be healed. The prayer of a righteous person has great power as it is working. Elijah was a man with a nature like ours, and he prayed fervently that it might not rain. And for 3 years and 6 months, it did not rain on the earth. Then he prayed again, and heavens gave rain, and the earth bore its fruit." I want to make 12 very quick observations about this passage. Observations that'll properly set our expectations for healing today. I'm indebted to my dear friend Rob Bowman and his book, The Word Faith Controversy, for these 12 observations. First, there are no itinerant healing ministries in James. The elders are called to the bedside of the sick, not the sick to the tents or amphitheaters of the healer. The only itinerant Christian ministers in the first century we know of who were gifted to heal were apostles and perhaps their associates. Second, there are no gifted healers in the congregation in James. Again, it is the elders, without distinction regarding their gifts, that are to be called. Third, there are no healing services in James, since again, the elders are called to the bedside of the sick. The practice of scheduling healing services or holding other meetings which promise people that healings will occur are utterly without basis in the New Testament. Of course, holding meetings in which Christians pray for one another's healing is perfectly legitimate and highly encouraged as a practice. Fourth, notice the elders do not command the sickness to leave in James. Instead, the elders are to pray to the Lord. Fifth, it is apparently not necessary to perform healing by laying on of hands. The apostles did this in the book of Acts, but the elders are not instructed to do so. Laying on of hands as a gesture of love and concern for the sick is fine. Laying on of hands as a sign of supposed authority to heal is without biblical basis, except for apostles and prophets. Sixth, it is false that all sickness is the result of sin. Note the example of Job given by James a few verses earlier. It's true enough that some sickness may be the result of sin, as verses 15 and 16 imply, but not all sickness. James says, if he has committed sins, implying that he might not have committed sins. We may not always be able to make a connection between sickness and some specific sin. Sickness, then, may be a consequence of sin, but not necessarily. The Lord has a purpose in everything, even in suffering and sickness. That said, sins might be relevant for at least three reasons. The sins may have directly caused the sickness, as in the case of drug abuse that damages the body. The sickness may be a divine alarm meant to bring a person to repentance. And the sickness itself may not be related directly or indirectly to any personal sin, but it gives the person the opportunity to sit quietly and reflect on his life. Seventh, it is false that sickness is always the result of demons. It may, in some sense and in some cases, be from the devil, as it was with Job. But even then, it's going too far to attribute all or even most sickness to the invasion of a demon. Thus, James says the elders should pray for healing, not cast out a demon. Eighth, it is false that Christians should rely on prayer and faith instead of medical means of treatment. Nothing in the text implies such a thing. Ninth, it is false that one's healing is always dependent on one's own faith. In James, it is the elders whose prayer of faith is the instrument of God's healing, not the prayer of the sick person. Of course, we can and should pray for ourselves as well, but it's the faith of the elders that's in focus here. Tenth, it is also false that perfect character and faith are necessary for the prayer to be answered. James denies this when he holds up as an example of an effective prayer that of Elijah, a man of like nature with ourselves. As you know, Elijah's life was filled with spiritual ups and downs, but he was right with God, he knew it, and that made his prayers effective. 11th, it is false that healing is always God's will. James doesn't address this idea explicitly, but his answer is already implicit in 4:15 when he says, "If the Lord wills, we will do this or that." What's more, by the prayer of faith, James doesn't mean a prayer that assumes without question that healing will take place. Rather, he means a prayer that is characterized by unwavering trust in God and confidence in his love and care for us. A prayer that is unwavering and unselfish and wanting whatever God wants. How do we know this is what James meant? Because this is how he describes faith elsewhere in his epistle. What he's saying then is that prayers for the sick are to be offered by the elders of the church with their trust in God. God might respond to such prayers of faith by making the person well, but he might not. After all, we know healing isn't always God's will for at least two reasons. One, we will all die from our last sickness if something else doesn't kill us first. James has already said in chapter 4 that we can't even know whether we will live tomorrow. Two, James is discussing only one scenario involving a need for healing, that of a bedridden Christian suffering from sickness. He doesn't discuss persons with sickness who can leave their house, or persons who are blind or missing an arm. Thus, James' statement cannot be generalized to mean that healing is always God's will. And 12th, it is false that God's healing in response to prayer is always overtly miraculous. It may be, but it might not. The passage says nothing about how they will be healed, or whether it will be instantaneous or gradual. B.B. Warfield compares this passage to James 1:5, where the Christian is told to pray for wisdom. James doesn't mean that we must sit and wait for wisdom to be dropped into our heads. Most of the time, it's a process. And at the end of the day, all healing, whether or not overtly miraculous, is good and comes from God. I assume you have a good sense by now that I'm not prone to extremes in either direction. Indeed, when it comes to miracles today, I think that there are two ditches to avoid and a middle ground to be walked. The first ditch is what we might call total cessationism. There are at least two reasons to steer clear of this ditch. First, and most importantly, there's no biblical warrant whatsoever for this view. Second, there's solid evidence, testimonially, for miracles that Christians really shouldn't deny that they ever occur. In his two-volume work on miracles, New Testament scholar Craig Keener devotes nearly 400 pages to cases of reported miracles, mostly healings, from around the world and throughout church history, including numerous examples from the late 20th century in the U.S. and other Western nations. Two cases that Keener reports have been repeatedly discussed and are worth noting. First, an 8-year-old boy with two holes in his heart was found to have no heart problems just a day after tests at a Missouri University hospital confirming the condition. Second, a 9-year-old girl who could not hear without a hearing aid and who had prayed for healing was found to have normal healing just a day after testing, which the doctor reported but admitted to having no rational explanation. Keener notes that in these unusual cases, medical records were available before and after the cure that documented the sudden and scientifically inexplicable change in the patient's conditions, and that both individuals were known to live for decades afterward with no relapse or related health issues. As Keener and others have ably shown, there is good evidence that miracles still happen. That said, there's a second ditch to avoid. We might call it total continuationism. Jesus is not physically present on earth, and we don't have living apostles or prophets who are authorized and empowered to be agents or instruments of miracles at will. Thus, some things are clearly different now than they were then. Not everything was meant to continue just as it was in the first century. In fact, as a matter of historical record, miracles were not as common in the second century and later as they were in the first century. Total cessationists are mistaken in thinking that miracles ceased, but total continuationists are mistaken in thinking that they continued unabated. The historical truth lies between these two extremes. Indeed, even in the Bible, miracles are not evenly distributed throughout biblical history or among God's people. Recall, for example, our observation about the Old Testament miracles clustering around three critical periods in Israelite history. When it comes to the New Testament, the period of time in which we see miraculous activity is actually quite short, less than 40 years. C.S. Lewis's observation still holds. God does not shake miracles into nature at random as if from a pepper caster. They come on great occasions. They are found at the great ganglions of history, not of political or social history, but of that spiritual history which cannot be fully known by men. If your own life does not happen to be near one of those great ganglions, how should you expect to see one? If we were heroic missionaries, apostles, or martyrs, it would be a different matter. But why you or I? Unless you live near a railway, you will not see trains go past your windows. At the end of the day, total continuationism sets believers up for disappointment or self-recrimination if they don't experience the miracle they think they need. Unfortunately, total continuationism is far more strongly associated with heretical and aberrant forms of Christianity than total cessationism. Despite their theological differences, Mormons and the Word of Faith movement, to name just two examples, proceed on the basis of an absolute continuationism. That fact alone doesn't disprove continuationism, but it does show why this extreme total form should be rejected. Fortunately, we don't need to choose between total cessationism and total continuationism. We may and should believe that God can and do miracles and that he does miracles as he pleases. We may and should also believe that God can be glorified in our lives, whether we experience miracles or not. Since miracles today are rare but haven't ceased, what should our attitude toward them be? I suggest an approach that is open but cautious. I think there's precedence for this in Scripture. Biblically speaking, discernment means being open to the Spirit while recognizing that not all claims of the Spirit are trustworthy. It means realizing the true and the good as well as error and the bad. See 1 Thessalonians 5 and 1 John 4 on this front. But how do we exercise this discernment? Are there any guidelines here? I think so. Clearly, we should be concerned when a miracle claim is attached to a heretical doctrine, like the so-called health and wealth gospel. On the other hand, a miracle claim might be about a genuine work of God, even if those who experience or report it have a defective or less mature doctrinal understanding of it. So sift claims through a biblical grid. Note the difference between teaching that is merely wrong on secondary matters and heretical on primary salvific matters. And be sure to note that the following reasons aren't good enough to accept a miracle as from God. It's not good enough to claim that it came from God. It's not good enough to simply quote a Bible verse in support of it. It's not good enough if it's something that just seems to be amazing. I've heard all of these reasons several times before given for supposed miracles. All of these reasons are inadequate. We need something more. So in that vein, there are some decent reasons to give a miracle credence as being from God. There are a few that come to mind. There are no red flags, especially doctrinally or ethically. It is naturally inexplicable, a necessary but not sufficient condition for a miracle claim. There is good testimonial evidence for it. This doesn't mean absolute proof. Above all, it glorifies Jesus Christ. So keeping all this in mind, where does the burden of proof ultimately lie? With the one claiming the miracle? Are the one questioning it? Evangelical philosopher J.P. Moreland suggests the burden of proof lies with disbelieving a miracle claim. He writes, "We want to avoid two extremes, gullibility and skepticism. Obviously, if it is clear that a miracle has happened, we should trust the report. And if the report just isn't credible, we should not believe it. But because we have good reasons to believe that Christianity is true, we should choose belief instead of doubt when it comes to events we experience or about which we hear, if an alleged miracle could go either way. After all, the problem for many of us is that we are naturalists deep down. Thus, for borderline cases, we should place the burden of proof on disbelief, not on belief." I think that there are alternatives to Moreland's dilemma. We may tentatively accept a claim, it could be. We may tentatively not accept a claim, it might not be. Or we might suspend judgment on a claim. I simply don't know. We may also accept a report of something presented as a miracle while holding varied opinions as to its miraculous character. We might agree that an event is a wonderful example of God's providence, even a special providence, while questioning or being unsure about whether it is a miracle in the strictest sense. My daughter's successful open-heart surgery comes to mind again here. When it boils down to it, I think the question we all want an answer to is this: can I expect a miracle? Since total continuationism is unbiblical, we should definitely not take the position that a miracle ought to occur, even if we do everything right. Even Christian thinkers who argue for greater openness to the miraculous caution that most people are not healed or given the miracle they seem to need. Affirming the reality of miracles also does not give us the right to ignore the fact that miracles very often do not happen. Tragically and disappointingly, large numbers of people who seek supernatural or natural healing are not healed. This observation seems to hold empirically true even in ministries that claim much supernatural healing, as most proponents of supernatural healing will admit. In fact, some famous Christians were not healed despite their belief that they would be healed, and despite many reasons to hope healing would happen. Johnny Erickson Tada is probably the most famous example of a Christian who needed a miracle but was not healed. She became a quadriplegic in 1967 due to a diving accident when she was just 17 years old. Ironically, two unrelated events, her dyeing her hair the night before and her sister being bitten by a crab right after Johnny started drowning, providentially saved her life. Her prayers and the prayers of many others for her healing were not answered with a miracle. As it turned out, however, Johnny's accident led to her becoming an inspiration to millions. Keener vastly understates the matter when he comments that her disability has allowed her to touch more lives than most other people touch. If ever anyone was sure to be healed miraculously through the concerted prayers of Christians, it would have been my very dear friend Nabil Qureshi. Nabil was a convert from Islam to Christianity who had an amazingly successful ministry before dying of cancer in 2017. Tens of thousands, perhaps 100,000 or more, prayed for Nabil. He had hands laid on him numerous times, including by Christians reputed to be the conduits of amazing ministries of miraculous healing. Many individuals publicly stated that they knew that God was going to heal Nabil, sometimes claiming to have received a word of knowledge to that effect. And the need was obviously great. A young man in his early 30s, with a wife and baby, and potentially decades of fruitful ministry ahead of him. Still, he died. God could have chosen to heal either or both of these individuals miraculously. There simply was no way to know ahead of time whether or not he would. I'll conclude with this thought. If we have assumed that miracles don't happen today at all, or that they are so rare as to not be worth considering, we should adjust our thinking to be more open to miracles. Yes, a minority of believers who pray for a miracle receive one. We don't know what the percentage is. We know it's low, but we also know it's not zero. So set aside a sense of entitlement, but don't hesitate to humbly ask for God to supernaturally intervene in a way that is above and beyond all that you might ask or imagine. And then rest in his sovereign wisdom.